Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is Joe Hagan. I'm here with Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
We are going to bring you today two interviews that are directly related to what's going on in the country right now. Mine is with Brandi Collins-Dexter of the civil rights group Color of Change, and she's going to talk to us about what's going on with Facebook in the midst of all of this and the problem with the disinformation and hate speech that is circulated by Mark Zuckerberg's company. And you, Emily Jane Fox, are bringing us who today?
I had a conversation with Maya Wiley, who is a former prosecutor in the Southern District of New York Civil Division. She is a legal analyst with NBC News and MSNBC and a professor at the New School, someone who has advised the mayor of New York City. She is a voice that I always want to hear from in any kind of legal situation, particularly this week. We got to break down what the charges against the four Minneapolis police officers actually mean, what is required. And it was a really illuminating conversation about the facts on the ground in a very practical way, what we need to know, what issues could come up as this goes into trial mode, and what we need to do to reform policing in this country. I think that you and I have been trying to do a lot of listening this week, and so let's just get right to the listening now and to these useful, informative interviews.
And here we go.
Okay, we are just the luckiest today to have Maya Wiley with us. Maya, you know I am president of your fan club. But in case anyone who's listening has not seen her as a legal analyst on MSNBC and NBC News, which feels impossible, I will introduce Maya as a former prosecutor in the SDNY Civil Division who's had a career in civil rights laws. She was a former advisor to New York City's mayor and a former board chair of the city's Civilian Complaint Review Board and a professor at the New School. Maya's voice is the voice I wanted to hear today. So welcome, Maya, and thank you for giving us your time here. I know how sleepless and busy this week has been for you.
Well, thank you, Emily. I'm a big fan of your work as well, and so it's an honor to speak with you, and it was just too hard to say no.
I love you for that. I love that. Let's just play a little bit of catch up. On Wednesday, the former Minneapolis police officer who pressed his knee into George Floyd's neck was charged with a new, more serious count of second-degree murder, and the three other officers on the scene during his killing were charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder. I'm going to start by asking you, Maya, with just a basic set of questions to lay out for us. Can you walk me through the difference between second degree and third degree murder in Minneapolis? And what's aiding and abetting?
Yeah, those are really good questions because legalese is like a foreign language for everyone. And we go to law school to learn that language.
I'm so grateful
for
that.
The short answer is, and I focus on the sentencing side because I think it's so important for the public to understand. The first critical difference is second degree murder. This officer is facing up to 40 years in prison. Under third degree murder, he would be facing up to 25 years in prison. So that's that already tells you that it is viewed as a much more significant crime, even though they both bear the word murder, be considered and to be charged with second-degree murder. The legal difference, just to put it in plain terms, is the difference between I didn't walk in planning to kill this person, But in the process of my doing wrong, in this case, this excessive force, my intent became to kill. And I don't mean intent like I said to myself, you're going to die and I'm going to make sure you die. But it's that my actions speak intent. The risk that I create creates enough of an intent. And the difference with third degree murder is more like heat of the moment and accidental. So it carries a little bit more. And again, I'm not using legal terms because the truth is it's more like the one police officer who was successfully convicted of third degree murder, well, actually of second degree murder in Minneapolis, for example, did shoot and kill a woman who called the police saying that she had heard screams. He was scared and shot into her home and killed her. Now that was second degree murder, but third degree murder would more be like, you know, you carried a gun, you got into a fight with someone, you started beating them, you intended to beat them, but they fell and hit their head and died.
Right.
So it's really a difference of degree. It's the way that prosecutors try to game out which they charge is very much around the facts and the circumstances, because no one tells you what they're thinking.
Sure.
And in some cases, intent in law is not about what you think consciously. It's about your actions were intended. And here the intent is, this officer kept his knee on George Floyd's neck, and they held him down because the other two officers also helped restrain for some period of time, despite his cries. But also, after one of the officers checks for a pulse and says there's no pulse, this officer keeps his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck for more than 2 minutes longer. That, if you play a timer, and you see how long it takes for 2 minutes to pass after someone's told you that the person is not breathing, that's intent. And the fact that those other, to your question about aiding and abetting means you counsel, advise, or otherwise support the crime. In this case, it's unintentional murder, meaning the underlying felony here was the assault, the excessive force, the aggravated assault. And they are deemed by the facts to have supported this murder by the fact that they physically participated in holding him down, that they watched and didn't intervene and stop, that becomes a form of agreement, a form of complicity. And remember, it was one of the other officers who's now charged with aiding and abetting that felt for that pulse and didn't feel it. Not one of those three officers said, wait a minute. And one of them, Officer Lane, actually made clear that they were concerned that this was putting him in harm's way, because he said on two occasions, should we turn him? Should we turn him? And when Officer Chauvin says no, they don't question it. They go along with it. So that's aiding and abetting. That is, we support you. We're in this. We're with you.
And they face up to 40 years in prison as well for that crime. Is that right?
That's exactly right. In Minnesota, and different state laws are different, so you have to look at the law of the state. But in Minnesota, aiding and abetting means you are guilty to the same extent as the person you help.
Wow. The way you just laid out how intent could be proved in a court of law is so important here, because as Keith Ellison, who's the Attorney General in Minnesota, said in his press conference on Wednesday, the upgraded and additional charges were not a result of public pressure, but they were a result of evidence that they have in their possession, evidence some of which we have seen, some of which I would imagine we have not seen. But there is such an uphill battle in court once these charges are brought against police officers. What kind of evidence would you need in order to prove these charges against these police officers?
Well, Emily, you know, I think one of the things we have to say up front here is that one of the reasons it's hard is because grand juries and a jury of the officers' peers find it very difficult to punish officers. So oftentimes it's less about the evidence that and more about not believing your lying eyes. So I say that because in this case, I think the evidence is very strong. That doesn't mean there aren't defenses. That doesn't mean we won't hear defenses. But oftentimes the defenses become, it's my word against the person or the witnesses who are saying I did wrong. Juries like to believe police. They don't like to believe that police don't tell the truth. They don't like to believe that police engage in misconduct. And in fact, many people have positive interactions with police. And that's why we see polls that say, for instance, 74% of Americans believe that police don't lie. Mm. If anyone who's had experience with police who do lie would be shocked by that. But that's the fact, because if you haven't experienced it, you don't believe it. So you believe the credibility of the officers. The issue here is that there is videotape. And that videotape and that time count and the fact that you have bystanders standing around saying, you're killing him. And we have that fact that the district attorney knew when the first complaint was filed, and we didn't see that fact in the complaint. But Keith Ellison, the attorney general, puts that fact in the new complaint, is that we hear George Floyd himself say, you're killing me.
Mm.
And those kinds of things are the evidence because they don't stop, because they make no effort to intervene or shift his position or call for medical help or anything that would be evidence that they did not intend to put him in this position that cost him his life and did not care that it cost him his life. That really is the point here. And while we will see a defense, we will hear, you know, as we've heard from people who knew him, that he was a gentle giant.
Mm.
What we will hear is, no, he was a big, scary black man.
Right.
We will hear, well, and he was sick. He didn't die because we did wrong. He died because he was sick.
Right.
And that is why the family got its own autopsy report, as it started to be concerned about what it was hearing in the medical examiner's report. Both conclude homicide. Homicide legally is not guilt of murder, but it's certainly your actions resulted in the killing.
Sure.
And they both conclude that, but they conclude it differently. And I think we will see the defense use that as a way to try to undermine the arguments of their guilt.
Sure.
One thing that's so important about the aiding and abetting, Emily, that is that it does create the possibility that an officer or officers will decide to cooperate to save themselves, and that will greatly strengthen the case.
So one of the three officers charged with aiding and abetting could strike a deal with prosecutors that would potentially lessen their sentence or punishment or conviction in order to help out in the case for second-degree murder.
That's right. Now, prosecutors would make the decision about whether that was valuable to them or whether they didn't need it. And so they, you know, how prosecutors will decide to proceed, we don't know. It is a possibility.
Sure. I think that we just got a little bit of a preview of it and all the hairs on my body stood up when I started hearing you talk about it. But what would you say? I know you don't have all the evidence and the time that they will take bringing this case to trial, but what would you say to the jury on the first day of arguments here? I'm sorry for my puppy barking in the background. Oh. She's very curious to hear what you have to say
as
well.
Never apologize for puppies.
That's exactly right. So what is the kind of stuff that we would hear you say to a jury in the opening day of this trial when it comes to me?
You know, what I would say is that the job of the police department is to protect public safety. And when police go against our laws and go against their training and ignore their better angels and take someone's life, That blue uniform cannot be a shield from justice. George Floyd was on the ground. He was handcuffed. He was crying out for his life. And these officers callously and cruelly and inhumanely and intentionally pressed the life out of his body. And that we must punish.
Ugh. That just made me take a breath. It's incredibly powerful and so difficult to hear. And I know that there is so much emotion stirred up just thinking about the time and thinking about the force. And as you just said, using the blue uniform as a shield has been something that I think the entire country is thinking about and talking about and learning about. Two of the four police officers who have charges brought against them have been officers who have a history of complaints against them for excessive force and a number of different things. There are systems and laws in place in this country that protect officers, and the systems and laws have made it extremely difficult for new police chiefs who do come into places like Minneapolis who want to reform their forces. It's very difficult for them to affect change because of police unions, because of police officers having the ability to self-report or report on one another, because of civilian boards that don't actually do what they're supposed to do, because of the constraints on bringing these criminal charges and the defenses that they're able to bring when these criminal charges are brought. And as you talked about grand juries not wanting to believe the worst in their police officers. I'm wondering what you think is a way to reform the system, both on a local and state level, on a federal level. What do we have to do in order for those complaints against officers to matter, to get people who have had a history of 17 offenses off of street policing? What is it going to take to get us out of the system and laws that we are currently in?
Thank you for that important question and for flagging, Emily, what is so central to the protesting that we are seeing in the streets in our communities all across the country. It's that lots of citizens of this country, residents of our cities, have experienced police misconduct. Even if they're not killed, they've experienced police misconduct. And that for far too long has been hidden inside police departments, meaning one of the things that we need to do and one of the things we need to change is the ability for police departments to hide the complaints and to hide whether or not they respond effectively to those complaints.
Mm.
That is something that does not exist in many states in this country. Even
right
here in New York State, the state where Eric Garner became the first person whose death produced the "I can't breathe" hashtag that we have devastatingly resuscitated in the wake of George Floyd's murder, is a state in which the state and the courts have interpreted the law to say that police departments and other agencies of government cannot reveal that complaints existed and what their outcomes were for law enforcement.
Mm.
If you can hide whether or not you are adequately responding to complaints, how many you get, what officers have gotten how many, and how that's been handled, you're essentially not accountable to the public that you serve in ways that every other public servant wouldn't even consider something that they could hide from. You know,
right,
we expect to be able to hold our public officials accountable and hold those who serve us accountable. So that is one. The second, you know, we were already hearing about it, is we can more forcefully pass laws that ban the bad behavior. So Representative Hakeem Jeffries, ever since Eric Garner's death, has a bill that's been sitting in Congress to ban these chokeholds that cut off the breathing of people coming into contact with the police. That's something that should be happening at the federal level, but it can also happen at state and local level. I think the other thing that is so critically important that needs to be part of our solution is culture change within police departments.
Mm.
You said it so rightly. We do have police chiefs in some of our departments who are willing to do the right thing. We have some police chiefs who won't, and they should be fired, frankly. But there are many police chiefs that care deeply about law-abiding police officers as well as law-abiding citizens.
Right.
But one of the things that requires is that we shift the vision of what policing is. You know, we have seen a 70% drop in crime precipitously over the last 30 years. And at the same time, we have invested in militarizing and growing police forces. In New York City, just to give you an example, in the early 1990s, we might have had 2,200 deaths, murders in this city. We've been below 400 murders for the past 8 years. Where's our peace dividend?
Mm.
Where is the shift that says, you know what? The role of police now is not the role of police in the 1970s. The role of police now is to identify hotspots, help identify underlying problems and causes, and partner and bring that information both to law enforcement in terms of how to better police the hotspots, not the entire community, but also how to shift so that it's information sharing for the parts of government that should come in with social services,
mm.
for the parts of government that should come in with the solutions to the causes of the initial problems. And we even have models of violence prevention that have data behind them, where we have violent felons, people who have killed or hurt other people, who come out of prison. They're trusted and respected in their communities because they come from those communities, and they have credibility on mediating and stopping violence before it happens. There's a track record here. There's data. It's called Cure Violence. It's in models in, I think, 20 cities in this country. Why it's not both national policy and why it's not a primary investment, when the only reason police officers or our residents are in harm's way is because we're not addressing what is underlying the problem. It will make police officers safer, probably enjoy their jobs more, mm. and feel more effective at them. It will also change their relationships to community, but that means they have to police differently. They have to see their role differently, and they have to understand that we have had decades of a shifting scenario in this country that's a good one. Where's our peace dividend?
Mm. That is so powerful and such an actionable way to think about change, and so many places to remind us that if we vote in November, these are things that we can talk to new representatives about, or representatives who we want to be in office again if we vote to reelect them. Something that you said struck me, that this is not the police force that we had in 1970, but we're also not living in the world that we were living in 1970, and there have been so many advancements. And in particular, this past week, I've been thinking about the cell phone video has to be probably the most influential invention that I could think of in modern times, particularly when it comes to policing. But not every incident is going to be caught on cell phone video. God willing, more will be, because we've seen what would happen when they are. But that's not likely. That is not possible. And so I'm curious what you think has to happen and what will happen so that we have confidence in our police force when the eyes of the world are not watching.
I think that's why we need transparency in what happens with complaints and discipline. You can't believe that people who have experienced abuse or seen and heard far too many stories of abuse that has gone unpunished, and in many instances, by the way, unreported because people are afraid to report it, especially when it's beat cops who know where they live, know where they go to work, know how to find them. I have heard this report from residents time and time again. Whether it's true or not, the fact is that many people believe they will have be punished by the police for complaining. And so until we have transparency, until the police departments invite the light of day into not just their practices, but where and how they see their problems and whether or not they are accountable to correcting them, we won't have trust. But it's also why I emphasize problem-solving policing, you know, the policing that should be our policing in the 21st century, because I think as police officers get supported to play a constructive and crime prevention role in communities, and less of a role that sees the community as potentially dangerous to them, that we will not change this problem. Mm. For Black people in this country, I have to say the problem has been that Black people are not believed when they say that there's abuse, which is why the video has been so necessary. But even with video, we have seen juries acquit. Remember Rodney King. That video was plain. It was clear. And we had a jury that said, we don't care. And so we have to shift the culture of the police department. But one of the things that's so hopeful to me is we have seen police who will lead. We have seen police who have admitted that there needs to be change, who we know that there are police who embrace change. But we're also seeing the American public have to confront the fact that it has for far too long seen Black people, seen Latinos, seen Native Americans if they live in communities with a high Native American population as people who are scary and dangerous rather than people who are mothers and fathers, rather than people who are looking for a job that helps them pay the rent just like everybody else. And sometimes people who have not been able to find one and become more desperate, but that those are solvable problems. It's not the color of our skin. It is absolutely the question of whether society will invest in true opportunity. And if we can shift the budgets, if we can shift the mindset, it's both about banning the bad behavior, but incentivizing the good.
I love ending with you on a note to be hopeful about. It feels particularly important on this very heavy week. And I feel like I have gotten from you what I knew I would get from you. It's that sense of hope, the sense of deeper understanding, and the sense of what we all need to do in order to make this country what we want it to be, and particularly in our support of the Black community. Maya, thank you so much for taking the time to explain all of that to us.
Thank you for caring so deeply, Emily, and for allowing it.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
Brandi Collins Dexter, welcome to Inside the Hive. I want to briefly introduce you here. You are from The Color. You're the senior campaign director at Color of Change. It's a civil rights group, as far as I understand, the biggest online civil rights group in the country. And you specialize in media, democracy, and economic justice. And I just want to point out, very interesting, that you were part of a successful campaign, I guess I could call it a pressure campaign, from Color of Change to remove Bill O'Reilly from the air, which yeah. Is an interesting kind of a feather in your cap. There's a lot of chaos going on right now, but in the middle of all of this protest and strife in the country, there have been some interesting shifts in the way social media companies are addressing what's happening. Last week, we saw Twitter began to flag Donald Trump's tweets, and specifically ones about, vote by mail is, quote unquote, going to be, automatically mean a rigged election, mm-hmm. Saying that, the protesters should be shot, right? And basically allowed to spread hate speech, misinformation, outright lies. And now that's changing at least a little bit on the margins there. And then we turn, of course, to Facebook and what's going on with them and how they are addressing the circulation of information. I mean, people are trapped at home nowadays. Their only access to what's going on in many cases are Facebook, Twitter, social media, right? That's where a lot of people are getting what they know. Last week, the head of your organization, Rashad Robinson, was a part of a conference call with Mark Zuckerberg to address some of this. Can you tell us what happened in that conversation? What was the kind of origin of it, and what was discussed, and what was the outcome?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. Just to go back a little bit before I go to the meeting. So Color of Change has been, and the organizations that were at the table, have been calling on Facebook for quite some time to really look at how its policies and practices are negatively impacting Black people, communities of color, marginalized communities. And so we've been at the table with Mark and Cheryl before. We called for a civil rights audit for quite some time. At first, they stalled on it. It actually didn't pick up gear until it didn't shift into high gear until Senator Booker mentioned it during the Zuckerberg hearings. And even then, it didn't move forward. Until we hit this moment where the New York Times released an article that talked about the ways in which Facebook was denying and deflecting all of the issues on their platform. And we were named Color of Change as one of the groups that they had hired a firm to spread disinformation about in the media. And when we went to the table with them and we met with Cheryl and Mark, I think 2 years ago at this point, we made the demand, hey, there's so much about this platform that you're responsible for that you need to get right. And so this meeting that happened more recently was part of a long attempt to really negotiate with Facebook on how they're dealing with hate speech, on how they're dealing with disinformation, on how they're dealing with voter suppression, on how they're dealing with census and ensuring that people are getting accurate information about that. And we've pushed them to release information and release policies and clarify policies. And they have put some new policies in place to deal with that. But the problem is when it comes to the president, those policies don't apply. And so this meeting and what was made very clear to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg in the meeting is that their unwillingness to, to take down content that's coming from the largest personality on social media, it means that all the time you spend trying to deal with disinformation, trying to deal with voter suppression, it's for naught, because when the president gets to immediately beam out that disinformation and not be censored on it, it doesn't matter what you do with the smaller sites. And so that was a part of, smaller bad actors. And so that was that conversation, making it really clear that Mark Zuckerberg has been a disappointment in how he's addressed these issues. They framed it as bipartisan when civil rights, right to vote, and right to have access to accurate information is not a partisan issue. It's an issue that impacts all of us. And they were urging him to really step up to the plate and do better.
Right. And it was interesting that Zuckerberg himself, after the comments about shooting protesters. He actually called Donald Trump before making that decision. You know, and there is this sense that he is, you know, beholden to the influence of the government in power right now because for financial reasons. But one thing you said I want to go back to was that a couple of years ago, it was revealed that Facebook had hired a PR firm in Washington, Definer, it was called, to kind of disseminate, you know, information to discredit Color of Change. Can you tell us a little bit about what had happened in that incident?
Yeah, and just to speak to your other point around the financial ties, I think it's financial ties, and it's also when you look at the people in Facebook's orbit, like you see that one of the prominent members of their board is Peter Thiel, who's a very close ally to the Trump administration, has used Palantir, his data mining company that's CIA funded, to work very closely with the government. His top right hand, one of their top people in Facebook, Joel Kaplan, was actually initially vetted for the Trump cabinet. He played a very critical role in not just getting Kavanaugh onto the U.S. Supreme Court, but actually even getting his nomination put up in the first place. And so all around him, there are decision makers who have a vested interest in preserving the president more than the sanctity of democracy. In terms of the Definer's issue, and so again, we first came to Facebook because we had organizers on the ground in Stone Mountain, Georgia, in Sacramento, California, and other places, Black Lives Matter protesters who were being doxxed in closed Facebook groups. And mind you, this was when President Obama was still in office. So this is before Trump and the whole conversation about like white nationalist groups. But in these closed groups, they were doxing these Black activists, and people were showing up to their places of work and to their home where their families were with guns. And we went to Facebook and we asked them to, you know, change their policy to take content down, to do a better job of preventing this kind of thing. And they stalled for a really long time. And so we kept going to the table, trying to negotiate with them in good faith, while also actively publicly campaigning against them. Joel Kaplan, who I actually referenced, was one of the people that we sent a letter to around calling for the civil rights audit. And he sent us a pretty like nasty letter back saying he wasn't gonna do that. Well, cut to the New York Times article, we find out with the rest of the world that while we were at the negotiating table with Facebook, you know, Joel Kaplan and his team had hired on this firm whose job it was to publicly discredit any groups that were going after them. So groups like Open Market Institute, and then we were named as well. They actually used some anti-Semitic tropes about us being like, you know, the puppet of George Soros, even though at that time right. that wasn't even one of our top 10 funders, but really like sort of relied on that. And that went into like right-wing outlets, and we actually started getting a lot of death threats.
Right. I read about this, and I think Rashad Robinson mentioned that, you know, being approached by some kind of shifty people on the street. And, you know, being rightfully worried about that. And so the point is, there's the consequences to them not only not addressing it, but actively working to not have to address it. And, you know, tell me, though, give some examples if you can. Maybe a lot of people listening to this podcast may not themselves have come into direct contact with some of the stuff that is circulating on Facebook that you're talking about and that you would like to see more attention paid to by Facebook in particular. So what's give me some examples of things that that you're finding on Facebook.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think part of what's been interesting about this conversation is that oftentimes Facebook tries to hide behind this idea that, well, we're preserving free speech. And, you know, putting to the side that actually free speech is around, you know, protection from government, not and corporations every day make choices, which is why we don't have a lot of ISIS Facebook pages. Right. You know, it's just what we're talking about specifically is like violent speech. So even Color of Change went out to our members. We have millions of members, and we asked them, what have been your experiences on Facebook? And some of the stories that we got back, we talked about one woman who came back from the Women's March and was receiving death threats directly through her Facebook messages from a guy that was looking up women within a 30-mile radius of him and sending death threats to them for posting about going to the Women's March. We've seen Islamophobic or anti-Muslim hate groups operating and encouraging their members to show up to mosque with guns. We've seen, like in Border Patrol and police closed Facebook groups, a lot of white nationalist content, crude jokes and images and threats to AOC and her, along with AOC, Maxine Waters, and, you know, the squad, quote unquote, as they call them, receive like the most death threats of pretty much anyone in Congress, and a lot of information about them and encouragement to incite violence we're seeing in all of these different groups flowing around. And that's not even to mention the groups that mimic Black organizer groups that are expressly trying to cultivate voter depression and voter disengagement.
Right. And right now, in the middle of all of this protest, we've already seen reports of, you know, kind of groups that are attempting to inflame more chaos, who are mm-hmm. bad actors. And of course, a lot of them have big online presences or presences in social media. Have you guys been monitoring that during all of this, you know, in the last week? As Facebook in particular been, Trump was the number one and most obvious kind of target of all of this. But like, are there other, what's been happening on Facebook during this? And are there other things that we should be aware of and keeping our eye on in terms of, you know, civil rights engagement?
Yeah. And also, I just want to mention one quick thing, too, you know, because we have talked about Trump and disinformation and some of the things that he said more recently. To me, one of the worst has been his disinformation around COVID-19 and what treatments work and what don't. I know at one point he was like urging people to go get lupus medicine. My sister actually has really severe lupus and couldn't get her medicine for a while because of like one post on Facebook or one tweet on Twitter immediately caused a run on that medication. So it's like, it's not just like the vile hate speech, but it's like this like undercurrent of false information that then have direct harms to lives. And so in terms of, some of the things that we're seeing right now, a lot of disinformation around COVID-19 in the early days, there were a lot of things that were said that Black people were not susceptible to COVID-19 because of melanin, because of a number of other things. And as we're seeing now, that spread of that and that, any slowness to crack down on that had direct implications for what we're seeing now in terms of, disproportionately high numbers amongst other things. That's one thing. We've seen groups, again, imitating, we've been tracking groups that have been imitating BLM, Black Lives Matter, imitating Antifa that are not authentic actors, that are setting up accounts and then actively encouraging violence in the streets and then having that be falsely attributed to those groups. And so there's a lot of that happening right now. There's a lot of false information around who's even involved in protests. We've seen a couple of incidences where pamphlets were circulated online that said this protest was being sponsored by BLM or the NAACP. And then those groups would come out and say, actually, we aren't, part of this. And so there's a lot of things that around this combination of spreading false information, cultivating hysteria, and then being able to like sort of frame up or point the smoking gun at actors who actually aren't the ones that should be held accountable. And of course, that's in addition to the continued white nationalism that we see running rampant. And actually, recent data shows that like recruitment is going up for white nationalist groups, and that Facebook is a very potent place for that level of recruitment.
Wow. Now, I mean, it all makes perfect sense, because if Facebook is not going to, you know, if their position is that we're just a communications device and we're not going to monitor any of this stuff. But you said that they do have policies in place, right? But they're just not implementing them. I mean, if you went to Facebook and said, hey, look, here's a hate group who's, you know, spreading disinformation, what do they say?
So, you know, as I mentioned, we have been pushing on this for a while, and we actually work with a group called Change the Terms, which is a coalition of several civil rights groups that came to the table and said, how can we develop meaningful policy for Silicon Valley? How can we actually be clear on what we're talking about when we're talking about hate speech? We're not talking about, like, I don't like this person, or we're talking about calls to violence. And so through that process of negotiation and the civil rights audit, we did get Facebook to put in place a policy, which they then used to take several accounts off of their site. However, again, part of what we're seeing, whether it's with Trump or other groups, is that there's these sort of special exemptions, and it just so happens that the people that get the special exemptions are the people that are actually the fastest vehicles for harmful information. So, right. It's one thing to take down this person who's like saying violent things to 100 people, but what does that matter if you won't take down, I'm not sure if David Duke still has a Facebook account, but if you're not taking down a white nationalist who has a more larger speaker box, or if you aren't censoring Trump. And so that's part of the not looking at that. We've also seen recently that they've kind of said, oh, because of COVID-19, we've had to, we don't have enough content moderators to really deal with this issue. First of all, I have questions around that, because I don't know how a tech company is not capable of getting people, set up to do that work. But even putting that to the side, basically what that means is, in the highest crisis point, where people are most scared, most vulnerable, and predators are most on the loose, you have fewer people there even able to moderate what's happening on the platform. So that's the other layer to that.
Right. Wow.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now, there at some point, Sheryl Sandberg and coordinated with your group to do some kind of civil rights audit, mm-hmm. right? And when did that happen, and what was it?
So that was, I'm definitely going to get my time mixed up, because it feels like dog years. So I'll say three years, but it feels like 10 years. Yeah. But we, around the time of the Zuckerberg hearings, whenever that was, we had already, 5 years ago, actually, we sent a letter to Facebook. It was us, then called Center for Media Justice, and some of us. And this, we called on them to do a civil rights audit. And that was something that was actually modeled off of Airbnb. Color of Change and other groups had worked with Airbnb before that to deal with discrimination on their platform. And they put forward this sort of unprecedented model of doing a civil rights audit to really look across all planks at what are the issues and failures. And they built civil rights infrastructure that still exists there to deal with bias. And so we took that model and attempted to apply it to Facebook. And again, at first they said no. Then, Cambridge Analytica happens. They get called in for testimony. We reached out to Senator Booker, amongst others, and asked him to press on the civil rights audit. He did. He got Mark Zuckerberg on record saying they would do it. And so then they brought in, an outside team, because part of the audit has to involve an external mechanism, right? Otherwise, it's not real. Right. And so they've released they're slated to release later this summer a third report based on some of the changes that they made. And I do have to say they have made several important changes. Like, I don't even know what we'd be dealing with if they hadn't made some of those changes. But the reality is that, you know, when civil rights or social justice groups deal with corporations, corporations always give a little less than they're capable of giving. And in this instance, when you have a platform that has more adherence than Christianity, like billions of people on their platform, and they are tampering with democracy in a number of different countries, like we're just talking US context, but like we've seen what they've done with Myanmar, we've seen what they've done in India, Brazil, other places. The fact that they have not put enough resources to actually getting that done, and the fact that they've declined to put a civil rights infrastructure in their like executive suite or on their board, I think really caught, but have like put in folks that have done everything they could to block that, I think shows you what their intentions really are.
Right. Do you think that this is all flows directly from Mark Zuckerberg himself and his, you know, personal, you know, vision of what he, you know, how he values this, frankly? You know, I mean, is this flowing from him?
You know, I think yes and no. I mean, I'll give an example. I manage a team of like 13. And do I know everything that's happening with all of those people? No. So can I imagine that Mark Zuckerberg knows everything that's going on? Not necessarily. I do know that a lot of Silicon Valley is built on Ayn Rand principles, and he is no different. These principles of objectivism, which are more geared towards, you know, rejecting regulation, allowing this sort of like free flow of chaos, with this idea that from that will become a natural democracy that replaces our current systems. And he's also said that like Augustus is like one of his idols. So take that for what you will. So I do think that he operates with quite a bit of he doesn't operate with a racial justice analysis, let's put it that way. And then when you add like who's on his board, Peter Thiel, when you look at the fact that they've had a purge of Black members from their board who have left for various reasons, when you look at the fact that they have someone in Joel Kaplan and Nick Clegg who are very much so like cognizant of preserving the legacy of President Trump and right-wing media and all of these things, that comes at the cost of basic civil rights for everyone. I think there's a lot of layers to bad decision makers. And then the last thing I'll say, though, is that the problem is that with Mark Zuckerberg, he owns so many shares of the board, he's chairman of the board, and he's CEO, right? So who's going to fire him? Who's going to hold him accountable? No one. So under that circumstance where, you know, he doesn't have to be held accountable, and then he's surrounded by those folks, it's really hard to get change outside of government regulation.
Right. I'm thinking about this. You and I are talking about policy. We're talking about things going on the corporate level in Silicon Valley. We're talking about the president of the United States. But I'm on Facebook. And, you know, occasionally there'll be these sort of, you know, calls to get off of Facebook, to disengage. Should I get off of Facebook?
I mean, you know, I don't know. Your life might be made better. Certainly I use it less, but then I use Instagram and WhatsApp, which is also owned by Facebook. So it's like, you know, what does it matter? But I'll say this, like, I think one, when you look at something that's the size of Facebook, I don't know how many countries in the world have 2 billion people, but like, how many people would you actually need to have an exodus from Facebook for it to matter to them financially or otherwise? That's probably more people than work. That it's certainly more people that will go out and vote in November. I'll tell you that much. But, you know, even putting that to the side, what they have amassed in terms of like data control, and in terms of like how they've been able to access people and information, it doesn't even matter. Like my mom, she's on Facebook more than I am. My dad never had a Facebook account, still calls it the Facebook. He has a data footprint that's been accumulated regardless of that. And so, you know, you can leave. And also it's a privileged standpoint because there's a lot of ways in which Facebook has become so ubiquitous that you can't even access certain content without like accessing it through Facebook, or Facebook is in schools. And so, like, really, that's why we need regulation, because it doesn't matter if you turn it off. It doesn't turn you off.
Right. That's a very good point. And I'm always, you know, the other thing is that in terms of spreading information that is accurate and that you want to be known, it's also remains a central hub for most people. And I'm thinking right now specifically about this upcoming election. And, you know, Facebook is going to be kind of a battleground in as much as, you know, your other media outlets are for how this election is going to be understood. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking specifically about this vote by mail issue. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the president. That tweet goes out. Facebook does nothing about it, and it cascades down through the Facebook system. And, you know, people read that, and there's going to be some chunk of people that take it as, you know, de facto truth, right? Mm-hmm. That there's something suspicious about mail-in voting, that there's somehow there's something not right about it, right? Which you and I both know that underlying that is it's barely a subtext. It's the text. It's like, this is about repressing, you know, minority votes and trying to repress Democratic votes. And so on that issue, to shift for a moment, Color of Change is also focused on this issue, right?
Yes. We have advocated for vote by mail, and we continue to.
Yeah. And, you know, the last sort of major example that we all, that sort of brought a lot of this to light was the Stacey Abrams versus Brian Kemp race for the governor of Georgia 2 years ago. Has there been any progress made? And where are we on that front in terms of going into 2020, you know, and trying to get everybody who can vote to vote? Because right now there's more energy than there's ever been. You know, this energy we're seeing on the streets is going to have to go to the ballot box, and it has to happen in a fair way. So where do we stand with that in terms from your point of view?
Well, we hope it goes to the ballot box, right? Because as we know, it's just in terms of what we found out about 2016, it's just what is talked about publicly is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the levels to which there was voter interference and trying to turn people off from actually casting a vote. But putting that to the side, also, so there is traction. I think there's less than there should be. We've seen a lot of states move forward, which is obviously part of what prompted this childlike outburst from Trump. I know I used to live in California. California's had vote by mail for years, and it has run pretty well. I live in Maryland, Baltimore now, and actually we're in the process of an election, and they're saying that I think something like 36%, I can't remember the number, of ballots that they have coming in are first-time voters. So we know as a country that if we value democracy and we value free speech and free thought and engagement, that it should be our priority to make sure that everybody in our country is able to participate in our democracy that is eligible. And we also know that, you know, that this sort of myth of voter fraud, hey, I don't know if it's half the country votes. I actually wish more people cared about fixing the election. But the truth of the matter is that we don't, that's not happening. However, what we have been pushing for and advocating for in Congress, and where we have seen traction, is federal vote by mail legislation. And so we would like to see that passed. We've seen a number of states put that on the books, at least temporarily, because, you know, COVID is not going anywhere. We still don't have a vaccine. Right. It's still not safe for people to be out in large groups, you know, voting at this time. And so we feel optimistic that something can happen. The problem is when the right to vote becomes a bipartisan issue, and the messaging from one party is that you don't deserve a right to participate in our democracy, and then that becomes, you know, the messaging of that platform, that really handcuffs our ability to make sure we all can be heard in November, regardless of where we stand.
Right. And I did see there are twinkles of hope in that like states like South Carolina changed their position to allow vote by mail in the primaries.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we can kind of see more of that, because obviously even Republican states, you know, don't want to not have votes, you know, or not have elections. You know, this is something that we're going to be keeping our eye on here at Inside the Hive over the summer, talking to different lawyers for the ACLU and the DNC and other organizations about where we stand with all of that. This is a remarkable time that we're living in. And I want to conclude by just asking, how are you doing?
Oh, what a question. So, I mean, it's hard, right? Like these times have been super hard. And I have to say I'm an introvert. I like to stay home. I'd been traveling on the road a lot for work. So I think the first 2 weeks I was kind of like, oh, I'm living my best life now. I think, you know, tensions have been high. Like this past weekend, actually, my nephew, who goes to college in Atlanta, there was video footage of him being, he was at a protest in his car, and the police repeatedly tased him, dragged him out of the car, arrested him, like threw him in a cell. Like it was awful. And like I found out, you know, through the video, and I remember seeing this kid that to me was still like a little kid, because the last time I'd seen him was years ago. He was like this really shy young kid that I helped write his like college essay. It wouldn't hurt anybody, like not that that matters, but like, you know, being attacked by the police this way. But like, this is a time where we're seeing so much protest, so much frustration, so much civil unrest that's born of economic hardship, police brutality, you know, health injustice. And I think now is the time that we really have to come together to be more aspirational about where we're going. And so I'm, you know, to answer your question, like it feels hard, but it's also like, what else have we got to do? we've just got to knuckle down and do it. Right.
Right. I have to say that I'm cautiously optimistic, just because we're at a juncture where obvious change is needed and being called for from people from all sides. Mm-hmm. You know, with Jim Mattis coming out this week and being very frank, really, about the divisions that have been sown up to this point and how those have to be mended. And that requires us to pay attention to this issue. And everybody knows that has to happen. Now, whether it can happen and how it happens will be where the rubber hits the road. But the fact that we now have a blank slate, or at least we've hit a reset button here, and how we go forward is going to determine our destiny. And so for that, I'm glad that maybe something can change. And I hope your organization is called Color of Change, and that's you guys are right in the center of it. So thank you for coming on this program and talking to us about it.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
And that's our podcast this week. I'd like to thank our guests, Brandi Collins-Dexter and Maya Wiley, for coming on the program during this critical week. I'd like to thank my co-host, Emily Jane Fox. If you enjoyed this conversation and you want to hear more like it, you can subscribe to this podcast at Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And please leave a review while you're there. I'd like to thank my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.